Good morning, everyone. It is good to see you. We announced Dana's passing this morning. Last week, we announced the celebratory news of Hannah Gobe's wedding to Corbin Knight. They were not here to hear that last weekend. Not really sure why they weren't here this weekend. It's not like they didn't have anything else going on. But they're actually here this morning, and so congratulations to Hannah and Corbin. It was a fun wedding to be a part of and a privilege to be a part of the pre-marriage process with them as well. So as we get started this morning, we're going to play a little game. I'm going to get your help on the game. This is one of those participatory games, so respond when you're asked a question. So this is a fill-in-the-blank game. And so the first question is, what is your favorite season of the year? Winter, fall, spring, summer. I really thought somebody would say election season. So speaking of election season, here's the deal. I don't know if you're aware or not, but we have an election coming up in just a couple of weeks. We do not intentionally, on purpose, get political. Here's the encouragement and the challenge that I have for us during this election season. Same one we had the last election season, and it'll be the same one that we have the next election season, is that no matter what your political stances are, be nice. Okay? With what you post on social media, with what conversations you have with other people, we have an opportunity to extend the grace and kindness of God in a highly divided scenario. And so just be kind, be gracious, and all of that. Okay? Can we do that? Yes. All right, we're going to do that. So that's it. You might hear me say that again next week, you might not, but that's going to be the general spiel every single time. Because we represent ourselves when we, whatever we do with the political stuff, we represent ourselves. You also have to remember that you do represent this place, and that you also represent the God that we serve. And so we want to approach this in a way that draws people to God rather than repels them from God. Can we do that? Okay, so now that we know everybody's favorite season is the election season, we'll move on to the next thing. What is your favorite type of restaurant? Mexican? Italian? Okay, somebody said Mexican and Italian both. It was the same voice. So you gotta pick one. Okay, so Mexican, Italian? Wherever you get free food. I like that answer. That's a good answer. Yeah. Oh, somebody said wherever you're buying. How about this is one that will definitely date us generationally. So this was clear. What is your favorite cartoon character? What was that one? Scooby-Doo. Okay, so see, there it is. There's the generational divide. Scooby-Doo, what was the one back here? Bugs Bunny, Woody Woodpecker, and then up here we get SpongeBob. So that's the generational divide, and SpongeBob back there. That's the generational divide that we get. So, since this is the last Sunday of Pastor Appreciation Month, who is your favorite lead pastor currently serving at Hurricane Community Church? Okay, that's really not a fair question. It's a loaded question. So here's another one. Who is your favorite child or grandchild? That's not really a fair question, because all of our children and grandchildren are our favorites, right? All of them are. We're not supposed to have favorites, right, when it comes to that. And so I had a really special relationship with my maternal grandfather. Not because we both shared the birthday of October 5th, but growing up, we would do things together. We would play baseball and basketball, and we would clear fences at the family farm, and we would do woodworking in the basement and stuff. When I was 16 years old, there were almost once a week after school, I drove from Perry Meridian High School to Southeast Street, and spend time with my grandpa almost every week without fail. Or sometimes I would go there and I would cut the grass for him so that he wouldn't have to. But there was a special relationship that I had with them. After my grandmother moved back up here from southeastern Kentucky, we were over at her apartment. I was putting something together for her. I can picture it in my head. I don't remember what I was putting together, but it was all laid out on the floor, and I was putting this together for her. And something was said about my grandpa that prompted me to jokingly say, well, that's because I was his favorite grandchild. And my grandma goes, well, that was true. You were his favorite. Now, I don't know if it was true or not, but even if it was true, you're not supposed to say that out loud, right? Because we're not supposed to have favorites. In some areas of life, it's okay to have favorites. It's okay to have a favorite restaurant. It's okay to have a favorite cartoon character. It's okay to have a favorite lead pastor. It really is okay. It's okay to have favorites in some areas of life. But there are other areas in life where sometimes we shouldn't have favorites, but we try to insert our name into the fill in the blank. We want to be the favorite of this or the favorite of that. And sometimes even in relationship with God, we want to put our name in as God's favorite. That I am God's favorite, I am special, I am this, I am that, and all of that. And when it comes to relationship with God, one of the things that is ironic is that God does not show favoritism while maintaining the ability to show favoritism to all. So God shows no favoritism, yet God shows favoritism to all, which is much of what Paul wrote about in the second chapter in his letter to Romans. And you'll remember, I said second chapter, but this wasn't in chapters. This was just a long letter that he wrote, and so we've broken it up into chapters, which makes it much easier for us to read. So here's what he says. He goes, now, you may think you can condemn such people, but you are just as bad, and you have no excuse. Now, Paul, at the end of what we have as chapter 1, his attention was directly on the Gentiles, or the non-Jewish people in the first century church in Rome. And he was talking specifically about them. And then he turns his attention to the Jewish people. He says, you may think that you can condemn such people, but you are just as bad and you have no excuse. So he's telling them, you like to point out all the things that the Gentile people do wrong. But when you do that, you're failing to look at your own life, and what you need to realize is that you're guilty of the very same things that you do to them. He says, when you say they are wicked and should be punished, which was right. The wickedness, the evil, the poor decisions of the Gentiles was clearly wrong and were worthy of being punished. Go ahead. You are condemned. You are condemning yourself, for you who judge others do these same things. So you're pointing out all the flaws in every. Remember the old thing when you point one finger at somebody, they have three pointing back at you. You know, this is kind of this deal. They keep pointing the finger at them and they fail to point the finger at themselves when they're guilty of doing the very same things. And then he goes, and we know, and the phrase we know right there means we agree. And it says, and we agree that God in his justice will punish anyone who does such things. So when God declares righteousness and justice, it will be in his justice. It won't be on the standard that we use to judge someone else. It won't be on the standard that we use to point out someone else's flaws and shortcomings. It will not be on the double standard that we often use, that what's okay for me isn't okay for you, and what's not okay for you is okay for me. It won't be on that type of thing. It will be on God's standard. And the Jewish people wanted to think that they were exempt from God's punishment because they were God's favorites, because God had chosen them and God had given them the law. And so because they were God's favorite chosen people, they were exempt from punishment. So when they broke the law, they weren't going to get punished, even though the very same things that they said the Gentile people should be punished for, they were doing. And it says, Paul is saying here to the church in Rome, no one is exempt from God's punishment. God's punishment will be in his justice. So it will be right, it will be fair, and it will be just, but it's not going to be exclusive. God's punishment will be for the Jews and the Gentiles, because God will punish anyone who does these things. The metric, the standard that is used for God's judgment will not be whether you are Jewish or Gentile. It will be about whether you have placed your trust in Jesus. That will be the standard. Jew and Gentile will not matter when it comes to this. And then he goes on to say, since you judge others for doing these things, why do you think you can avoid God's judgment when you do the same thing? The reason they thought they could avoid God's judgment was because they thought they were special. They thought they were favored. They thought, and clearly they were special and they were favored. God did choose the nation of Israel to be his set apart holy people for a purpose. And the purpose that he set them apart for was to have a unique relationship with him so that through them other nations would come to know God. The nation of Israel took this promise and said that it was exclusively for them, and it was not for the non-Jewish people, it was just for them, and that therefore everyone else was condemned, whereas they would be saved. And Paul says, why do you think that you can avoid judgment? You're doing the same things. And so if that's the standard you use for their judgment, it will be used for you as well. He says, don't you see how wonderfully kind, tolerant, and patient God is with you? Does this mean nothing to you? Can't you see that his kindness is intended to turn you from your sin? God would have the ability to enact his punishment, his justice, his wrath on the world at any given time. God could enact punishment for sin individually, collectively, universally. He could do it at any moment. And it would be right and just and fair to do so in response to sin. But Paul says, don't you see how wonderfully kind, tolerant, and patient God is with you? And again, when you consider that he's writing to the Jewish people specifically and addressing them in this part, it would be amazing to realize that the pattern of the nation of Israel was to turn to God, get distracted from God, make all sorts of really, really bad decisions, wind up in exile or slavery or in some type of less than desirable circumstance as the result of their own decision, which was turning from God. Then when they were miserable, they would cry out to God for rescue, for salvation, and then God would send someone who would rescue them and deliver them from their exile, deliver them from their bondage, deliver them from slavery, deliver them from the consequences of their own decisions in some ways, only to have Israel lather, rinse, and repeat. That was the pattern. And so when Paul says that, don't you realize how kind and patient and tolerant God is with you? He would just say, go look at your history. And the constant in that history is that God has always been kind and tolerant and patient. And he goes, does this mean nothing to you? You would think at some point that continual outpouring of grace, that continual outpouring of mercy, that continual outpouring of patience and kindness and tolerance would at least in some way soften the heart of the nation of Israel for a longer period of time than this pattern to simply repeat itself over and over and over and over. And he says that, can't you see that this kindness is intended to turn you from your sin? And the phrasing there is to literally turn you away and head a different direction. He says, but because you are stubborn and refuse to turn from your sin, you are storing up terrible punishment for yourself. So not only when we make these decisions are we left to the consequences of our own decisions, which is right and just and fair, by the way. he says that you're storing up terrible punishment for yourself. He says there's a day. There's something yet to look forward to, that a day of anger is coming when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. So the perspective that he wants them to gain isn't just about the here and now. It's not just about life now, though life now is very important, and the decisions we make now matter, and how we live our life now matters. But there's a day coming. There's a day when God's judgment will be revealed. And when that day comes, where will you stand? How will you stand? The nation of Israel believed that they would stand as a favored people before God, regardless of sin, because they had been given the law. And he says, you are storing up incredible punishment for yourselves. And then he goes on to say, he will judge everyone according to what they have done. Everyone means everyone. It doesn't mean just the Gentiles. It doesn't mean just the Jews. It doesn't mean just the men, just the women. It doesn't mean just the kids, just the adults. It means everyone. Everyone means everyone. And he says he will judge everyone according to what they have done. The phrase what they have done has also been translated according to their deeds. And we will stand before God and we will be judged according to what we are done. And then there's a tension that we run into almost immediately when we talk about being judged according to what we have done. Because all throughout the biblical narrative, you see and hear that salvation is by grace, not by what you have done, not by works. Salvation is by grace through faith and not according to what you have done. And so what does this mean that we're going to be judged according to what we have done? What it means is that though salvation is by grace through faith alone, that does not absolve us of the responsibility for our decisions in how we live and how we treat each other and those types of things. That there is a personal responsibility that we do carry for the decisions that we make. Philosophers and they agreed clearly that a person's walk should match their talk. Sin was considered a folly to Greek philosophers. Sin was considered an affront to God, to Jewish scholars. So the way we live, the decisions we make, matter deeply. What we do matters. What we do cannot earn our salvation. Salvation is by grace alone. But we do have personal responsibility for our decisions, and we have personal responsibility for whether we accept or reject salvation by grace alone. Not that accepting is a work or a deed, but it is grace alone that saves. He goes, he will give eternal life to those who keep on doing good. And the phrase keep on there is and the word seeking there is for someone who is earnestly striving for something, continuing to work for something. The idea here is that we are wholeheartedly devoted to receiving the gift that God is giving for eternal life and living out in a way in response to that. So those who keep on doing good are those who are wholeheartedly devoted to living the way that God desires for them to live, seeking after the glory and honor and immortality that God offers. And then he goes on to say, but he will pour out his anger and wrath on those who live for themselves, who refuse to obey the truth, and instead live lives of wickedness. So you have a contrast. You have a contrast between those who continue to do good, to those who are wholeheartedly seeking right relationship with God and living a life in response, and those who don't. And the contrast is that he will pour out his anger and wrath on those who live for themselves, who refuse to obey the truth, and instead live lives of wickedness. And then, in verse 10, what is wholeheartedly sought after in verse 8 and 9 is what is received in verse 10. So go ahead. There will be trouble and calamity for everyone. Trouble and calamity means a narrowness of space. Almost like a type of confinement. And it says, for everyone, and we know that the word everyone means everyone, who keeps on doing what is evil, for the Jew first and also for the Gentile. This is not about an order of favoritism. It is a way of indicating for the Jew also first and also for the Gentile. It's drawing attention to the Jewish people that this is a reality for you. You think you are God's favored people, but you are in the midst of everyone who keeps on doing what is evil, so you will be considered just like the Gentile and all that. So it's inclusive of the whole of humankind. Okay, now we go to verse 10. It says, but there will be glory and honor and peace from God for all who do good, for the Jew first and also for the Gentile. What is earnestly sought after in wholehearted devotion to God is received here from God. Glory and honor and peace from God for all who do good. And then for the Jew and the Gentile means the inclusiveness of humankind. When we stand before God, Jew will not matter, Gentile will not matter. What will matter is whether we have placed our trust and obeyed the truth, just as Paul has talked about. He goes, there will, for God does not show favoritism. This idea of not showing favoritism would have come as a shock to his Jewish readers. It would have come as a shock to many of his Gentile readers, because the culture was so immersed in this idea of favoritism that there were people who were in and there were people who were out. Just because you were born a Jew or not born a Jew, or because you obeyed the law or didn't obey the law, which again, nobody fully obeys the law. And when you break one part of the law, you're guilty of breaking the entire law. And he says very clearly, God does not show favoritism. When God looks at us, he sees us in relationship with him. He says, when the Gentiles sin, they will be destroyed, even though they never had God's written law. Destruction was what the Jewish people wanted for the Gentiles because of their wickedness. It's what they hoped for. Instead of hoping that they would be reconciled to God, they were hoping that they would be destroyed. And he says, the Gentiles will be destroyed, even though they never had God's written law, which doesn't really seem fair. Because if you didn't have the written law, how did you know what the difference was? And he says, and the Jews who do have God's law will be judged by that law when they fail to obey it. And he draws a contrast here. There are people who will be judged by what is right and wrong, by God's standard, which they will know, which is what he will talk about in a minute. And he says, and then there are those who have the law. In other words, you should know better. You've clearly been told. It's clearly been laid out for you. The other people, though, they have no excuse either because it's written on their hearts, which is, again, what he talks about in a minute. But he says, they'll be judged and you'll be judged. You should know better. They're going to be judged according to God's standard. You're going to be judged according to God's standard. But God's standard to you was clearly communicated in the law, so you should know. Then he goes on. He said, for merely listening to the law doesn't make us right with God. It is obeying the law that makes us right with God. And again, the context of this is having placed our trust in Jesus. It's not about obeying the law. It's about placing our trust in Jesus. And he says, it is obeying the law. And the idea here is that the Jewish people would have sat all of their entire lives and heard the Jewish law. They would have known the Jewish law. They in many instances, would have memorized the Jewish law, which for us is what we have as the first five books of the Old Testament part of the Bible. They would have literally almost memorized that entire thing. And he says, you know it, you've heard it, but you don't do it. And if you know it, and you've heard it, and you don't do it, what's the point of knowing it and hearing it if it doesn't make any difference in how you live? You're not made right by simply sitting and listening and hearing. You're made right when you go do. Having placed your trust in Jesus, going and doing is what shows and is the evidence of your relationship with God. He said, even Gentiles who do not have God's written law show that they know his law when they instinctively obey it, even without having heard it. There are things in every culture that are considered right, and there are things in every culture that are considered wrong. Whether those cultures know, the Greco-Roman culture, though it was a very wicked and immoral culture, it was not a lawless culture. There were laws that you could break. There were things that were deemed right. There were things that were deemed wrong in the Greco-Roman culture. They didn't know. They may not have known that those ideas of right and wrong came from the character, nature, and person of God. But there was something that they knew instinctively about what was right and about what was wrong. So even though they didn't have the written law, they knew right and wrong instinctively. You ever done something? I've not even been able to think of an example of this. But have you ever done something that you had never been told was right or wrong, but when you did it, you immediately knew? You immediately knew, I should not have done that. Well, how did you know that? Nobody ever told you it was right and wrong. I mean, I spent 34 years of life never realizing I did anything wrong. And then I got married. And before then, I never had anybody tell me I was wrong. And then after I got married, suddenly I realized, holy cow, I'm wrong. A lot. And then I had two kids. And now I realized I'm the stupidest man who ever walked the face of the earth. I'm wrong all the time. There is nothing I'm ever right about. But we just knew instinctively it was wrong. Or have you ever done something and you knew when you did it, oh, that was just the right thing to do? How did you know? It was instinctive. You knew. Because it's written in our hearts. He says, they demonstrate that God's law is written in their hearts. Not on a stone tablet, but on the heart. For their own conscience, something inside, and their thoughts either accuse them or tell them they are doing right. This is one of the clearest things, that it's not about the law. Was the law important? Yes, there was a reason God gave the law. But guess why God gave the law to the nation of Israel? For this. God gave the law to the nation of Israel to clearly delineate right. And he put it, he put what was in their hearts in writing. He said, you know these things. You know, and so just to be clear, just to be sure, here you go. We're putting it all in writing for you. And so those people who had never seen the written law were still without excuse, because God's law had been written on their hearts and their conscience told them. And then Paul goes, and this is the message I proclaim, that the day is coming when God, through Christ Jesus, will judge everyone's secret life. Uh-oh. So it's not just the things I do. It's not just the things people see me do. It's what I do in secret that nobody knows. Uh-oh. That's frightening for some people. Because we know our secret life. And Paul wants them to know, it's not just about the outward behavior. It's about what's written on our heart. And the wording that Paul uses all throughout this isn't about just external conduct. It's about the internal motives and the thought process. It's the reasons why we do what we do. You know, and he says he'll judge everyone's secret life. And then he goes, you who call yourselves Jews are relying on God's law. And you boast about your special relationship with him. The Jewish people took the law and said, since we have the law, we are highly favored by God. You didn't get the law, so na-na-na-na-boo-boo to you. And because you didn't get the law, God doesn't see you like he sees us. And Paul flips that script upside down and said, no, you don't understand. Yes, God gave you the law, but he sees you just like the Gentiles in relationship to sin. Because guess what sin is? Sin is sin, no matter who does it. Sin is sin, no matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile. You're relying on God's law. And you even boast about that. They would take the law and they would literally hold it over other people's heads as judgment and condemnation for them, whether they had ever received or heard the law to begin with. And then Paul uses some, in the Greek language, he uses what's defined as force of present verbs. And what that means is, what he's talking about is an ongoing, continual pattern of behavior. It's not just things that were done in the past. It's not just things that will be done in the future. It's not just things that will be doing now, but it's a pattern of behavior. He goes, you know what he wants. You know what is right because you have been taught the law. They would have been taught the law in their homes. They would have been taught the law in the Jewish educational system. They would have been taught the law in the synagogues. They would have been taught the law as they went about their daily lives in their family. They would have been taught the law and they would have known the law. And then he goes on to say, you are convinced that you are a guide for the blind and a light for people who are lost in darkness. Now this is just amazing to me. Someone who holds the law over the head of other people, condemning them and judging them and desiring their destruction. The Jewish people called Gentiles Gentile dogs and wanted nothing to do with them and were not supposed to associate with them. But Paul says, you're convinced that you are a guide for the blind and a light for the people who are in darkness. If they had genuinely been taught the Jewish law, they absolutely would have been convinced of that because they would have heard about the promise that God made to Abraham centuries before that told them that all people would be blessed through the nation of Israel, that the nation of Israel would be a light to other nations. And the phrasing blind and darkness here is used as an allegory or an analogy to spiritual and moral darkness, spiritual and moral blindness. Now, when my paternal grandmother got older, she began to suffer from macular degeneration. And she got to the point where she couldn't see. And when we took her places, she depended on us to help her get where she needed to be. So I thought it was fun based on the relationship that I had with my grandma. My grandma was 95 years old, but she was a 16-year-old girl trapped in a 95-year-old body. She was silly and giggly, and there was one day where I was working here at the church, and Denise and the kids, when they were younger, had gone to lunch with her at Steak and Shake in Franklin. We always went to Steak and Shake or Dairy Queen in Franklin, one of those two places. And so Denise called and said, Dan, she said, you're not going to believe what your, she was 88 at the time. She said, you're not going to believe what your 88-year-old grandma is doing. And I'm like, oh Lord, what? That she's teaching our children how to spit spitballs with straws. She was silly and goofy, and she was so much fun. But when she had macular degeneration, she depended on us. So I thought it was fun to just run her into doors. Okay, so I never ran my grandmother into doors. But you get the point. That someone who is blind requires someone who is dependable and trustworthy to lead them and guide them where they need to be. To lead them and guide them where they cannot see for themselves where they need to be. If I took my 95-year-old grandmother who was suffering from macular degeneration and could no longer see and ran her into doors, that would be cruel. That would be wrong. And in some ways, it's almost what, like what the nation of Israel was doing when they would hold the law over people's heads and condemn them and judge them. They were supposed to be a light to the nation, but they wanted to keep God all to themselves. And God said, that's not what you're supposed to do. You're convinced that, and you should be. He goes, you think you can instruct the ignorant and teach children the ways of God, for you are certain that law, God's law gives you complete knowledge and truth. Do you hear the arrogance in this? And that's the point that Paul's making. He says, well, then if, and then this gets really personal, if you teach others, why don't you teach yourself? That was a very, very common, actually, in Jewish rabbinical writings. So it's not just Paul saying this about the Jewish people. The Jewish rabbis had said it about the Jewish people. That phrase, why don't you teach yourself, was very common. He said, you tell others not to steal, but do you steal? You say it is wrong to commit adultery, but do you commit adultery? You condemn idolatry, but do you use items stolen from pagan temples? All of those things that he just listed were things that were contained in the law. All of them. Every single thing that he listed. And he said, you teach other people that these things are wrong, but if you look at your own life, aren't you doing the very same things? He said, you are so proud of knowing the law, but you dishonor God by breaking it. No wonder the scriptures say the Gentiles blaspheme the name of God because of you. When he references the scriptures here, he may be referencing Isaiah 5:25, or he could be referencing Ezekiel 36:20, or he could be referencing when the king of Israel, David, was confronted by Nathan for his sin, or he could be referencing, and the point is that there are many, many options from which he could be referencing. They've narrowed it down to some that they think, but the reality is, because of Israel's pattern of behavior, there were many options to choose from. It's almost like if Paul stood and said, hey, what's your favorite season of sin in the nation of Israel? Oh, well, Mexican or Italian or pizza or, you know, and they had this slew of options to choose from because it was a pattern of behavior. Breaking the law was a pattern of behavior for the nation of Israel, and their history spoke for itself. And then he says the Jewish ceremony of circumcision, which would have been the outward symbol of a right relationship with God, has value only if you obey God's law. But if you don't obey God's law, you are no better off than an uncircumcised Gentile. That would have been like a 2x4 to the face of the Jewish people. They underwent the practice of circumcision as an outward reflection of their favored status before God. But Paul basically says that outward symbol means absolutely nothing if you don't actually do what you're supposed to do. It means absolutely nothing if you don't live the way God desires for you to live. He's given you the law, it's clear. And you are so proud and arrogant of knowing the law, but you remain guilty by breaking it. And here's the deal. If you don't obey the law, the Gentile people who are not circumcised are better than you. You're no better off than them if you're not obeying the law. And he says, and if the Gentiles obey God's law, won't God declare them to be his own people? Which is what was said about the Jewish people when God made the promise and gave them the law, that they were his own. I will be your people, or you will be my people, and I will be your God, is what was said to them. And now, if the Gentiles obey God's law, which is instinctively written on their hearts, by the way, whether they've got it written or not doesn't matter. God will declare them to be their own people. And so again, when you stand before God, it is not about whether you are Jew or Gentile. It is about whether you are in right relationship with him. He goes, in fact, uncircumcised, this gets better just so you know. In fact, uncircumcised Gentiles who keep God's law will condemn you, Jews, who are circumcised and possess God's law but don't obey it. So in other words, you've held the law over their head, you've condemned them, you've judged them, you've tried to hold God all to yourself, but when they get in right relationship with God and you continue breaking the law, they're going to be the ones condemning you. And it will be right, and it will be just, and it will be fair. And then he goes on, "For you are not a true Jew just because you were born of Jewish parents, or because you have gone through the ceremony of circumcision." In other words, all the things that you have believed set you apart don't set you apart like you think they do. And then he goes on to say, "No, a true Jew is one whose heart is right with God. And true circumcision is not merely obeying the letter of the law. Rather, it is a change of heart produced by the Spirit. And a person with a changed heart seeks praise from God, not people." In other words, the outward behavior that we manifest is manifested from the heart, a changed heart. You're not a Jew just because you were born of Jewish parents. You're not a Jew just because you underwent circumcision. You're not a Jew because you have possession of the law. You are a true Jew. And the phrase there is not ethnically driven. The phrase there is relationship with God driven, because he's saying, you know, you think you're a true Jew and you're in right favored status with God. You're God's favorite because you're a true Jew. He said people who are really favored by God, people who are true, authentic, in right relationship with God, are people whose hearts have been changed. And people whose lives have been changed as a result of the heart that transforms. You see, in some areas of life, it's okay to have favorites. But when it comes to right relationship with God, God shows no favoritism. It doesn't matter whether you were born into a Jewish family. It doesn't matter whether you were born into a Greco-Roman family. It doesn't matter whether you were born into a Muslim family. It doesn't matter whether you were born into this country, that country, this political camp, that political camp. It doesn't matter. What matters is the condition of your heart and whether you've placed your trust in Jesus. Because though God doesn't show favoritism, he extends his favoritism to all by extending his grace to all. So ironically, a God who shows no favoritism is able to show favoritism to all. And all means all. And the condition of our hearts determines whether we accept or reject the favoritism that God extends to us. Let me pray for this morning. Dear God, thank you for this incredibly powerful, challenging, difficult portion of this letter written by Paul to a people he cared deeply about in a church he had never visited, a place he wanted to go to encourage and strengthen and build into. But in the meantime, spent time writing to them to help clarify what they believe and what they understand and about being made right with God, but not just about being made right with God, but living right with God. God, I personally thank you for being someone who does not show favoritism, because if you showed favoritism, I might be on the outside. but because you found a way to show favoritism to all. The invitation to right relationship with you was given to me, given to everyone here today, everyone watching online, everyone who will watch online later, and even everyone who never hears this message. Thank you for loving us enough to instinctively write on our hearts right from wrong, and the opportunity to be in right relationship with you. Pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for choosing to spend this part of your day with us. We'll roll the preview video for you. And in exactly 7 days from now, it will be 10:05. So don't forget to move your clocks back.